Jen says if he had fallen in love with a televangelist, he would have become one. If she had joined ISIS, he would have. He was that much of a follower. He was drawn to extremists, people he found really exciting. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Welcome back to the Shelter and Warning podcast, and thank you so much for joining us today. We are a Monster of the Week podcast, literally. So every episode, we cover a new monster. Monsters can be both fact and fiction, and they're usually hiding in plain sight. The more you know about monsters, the better equipped you are to protect yourself if you ever have to face one. A quick note before we start, if anything I say is inaccurate, insensitive, offensive, or should be added to, contact me. I'm trying my best to find accurate information on my topics, but I welcome all corrections and would love to have an open dialogue on any larger issues. All social media handles and my email will be in the description, and I'll say them at the end of the episode, so stay tuned for that. Trigger warning as well for talk about drugs and substance abuse, sexual assault, and death. None of these will be talked about in depth, but they will be mentioned. Our topic today, the California witch killers. How did this couple twist religion to suit their own gains? Where are they today? And what does this case tell us about cults and how to survive them? Stats. Susan and Michael Bayer committed three murders from the years of 1981 to 1983. Their victims were 23-year-old aspiring actress Karen Barnes, 26-year-old cannabis farmer Clark Stevens, and 30-year-old hippie John Helyar. Both Susan and Michael were sentenced to 25 years to life in prison, and neither have been paroled. As of April 2021, Michael and Susan are 70 and 79 years old respectively, and will most likely spend the remainder of their lives behind bars. Michael Bayer was born James Carson. He lived in Arizona with family and was a house husband, staying home with his daughter Jenna while his wife worked. Jenna remembers her father as a loving and brilliant man, but as she grew older, his temperament began to change drastically. James either refused to look for a job or he couldn't get one, and he was increasingly angry, hopeless, and violent. Because of this change and the fear that he would hurt her young daughter, James's wife divorced and left him, completely hiding herself from him. Because of this change and the fear that he would hurt her young daughter, James's wife divorced and left him, completely hiding herself from James. Also in Arizona lived Susan Barnes, who was a rich housewife known for hanging out with and selling cannabis to her son's underage friends. Susan started to have what she called visions, and they only cemented the idea that she was destined for something more than her suburban life. However, it's much more likely that the hallucinations came from a combination of the large amount of hallucinogens and psychedelics Susan was taking at the time, combined with either mental illness or lucid dreaming. Because of these visions, combined with her increasingly erratic behavior, Susan's husband soon divorced her. Susan Barnes then changed her name to Susan, swapping out the middle S for a Z, and met James Carson at a party. The first words they exchanged were Susan telling James that his name was Michael, to which he responded, "No, my name is James." She said, "No, you are Michael, an angel of God." James accepted this and quickly started going by Michael. Soon after, Susan had a vision that the couple should change their last name, so they unofficially became Susan and Michael Bayer. This type of behavior is emblematic of shared psychotic disorder, colloquially known as folie à deux. It's a shared delusion that almost always occurs between two people, although in rare cases, more than two can be involved. The primary partner, in this case, Susan, has a delusion that transfers to the secondary partner, in this case, Michael. There's a lot of complexities involved, so if you're interested, definitely do more research, but psychologists have pretty solidly diagnosed Michael and Susan with this condition, with Susan pushing her delusions onto Michael. Susan also claims to have had visions that directed her to Islam and that God had told her to hunt and kill witches, with Michael acting as her personal mercenary. Of course, Susan must have missed the part of Islam that prohibits mind-altering substances, murder, and creating your own cult that is a bastardization and a mockery of what Islam actually is. While Susan and Michael self-described as vegetarian Muslim warriors, they were anything but, and everything they did tainted the name and idea of Islam. After a year spent traveling around the world, Michael and Susan ran out of money and were forced to return back to the United States, where they decided to move to San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury neighborhood. The counterculture movements of the 1970s were in full swing, and California was where hippies and people who wanted to be hippies hung out. Once in San Francisco, the couple would attend parties and try and convert others to their ideology. Obviously, that didn't work too well, as they were oddly combative and socially awkward while talking to each other in what almost seemed like a coded language at some points. However, young aspiring actress Karen Barnes took an interest in this odd couple. She'd moved to California recently and was known to be open-minded about the spiritual and religious, so when she met the Bears, she was intrigued. Karen allowed them to stay in her apartment, which she quickly regretted. The Bears were stubborn, awkward, and prickly at the best of times, and the relationship between them and Karen quickly devolved. Things came to a head when Susan mentioned to Michael that she just had a vision. Karen was a witch, and the Bears needed to kill her. On the evening of March 6th, 1981, Karen Barnes came home from work like normal. Susan and Michael followed her into the kitchen, where Michael hit her over the head with a pan and then stabbed her 13 times. They then wrapped Karen's body in a blanket, drew odd symbols and the word Susan on the walls, and then left town. The next day, police found Karen's body. They had almost no leads other than the Susan on the wall until one of Karen's friends told them about her new odd roommates. When the police spoke to Karen's mother, she told them the couple's names, but because the Bears hadn't legally changed their name, the police were unable to find them in any databases or records. After almost a year, the investigation stopped and the case went cold. Meanwhile, the Bears hitchhiked north of California and started living in an abandoned cabin out in Oregon. They stayed there for almost a year, waiting out the police and hoping to resume their lives. Meanwhile, the Bears hitchhiked north of California and started living in an abandoned cabin out in Oregon. They stayed there for almost a year, waiting out the police and hoping to resume their lives. However, the cabin was far from a comfortable shelter. At one point, Michael spent over 3 weeks hitchhiking to California and back for supplies, and by the time he returned, Susan had nearly died from starvation. Their time in the cabin ended when a park ranger found them squatting and kicked them out. The Bears decided to go back down into California and stay with a friend of theirs. However, once the friend realized what they were like, he kicked them out of his house. In retaliation, Susan and Michael robbed his house and stole a handgun. They finally found a somewhat permanent place to live and work on a cannabis farm that another friend of theirs owned. At first, the Bears were quiet and kept mostly to themselves, getting their work done and not really interacting with any of the rest of the workers. That changed when 26-year-old Clark Stevens, who is also a friend of the owner's, came to work on the farm. Everything about Clark, from his loud way of speaking to his partying and drinking, rubbed Susan the wrong way and went against her so-called religion. The straw that broke the camel's back was when Susan tried to block Clark from entering the farm one morning and he insulted her to her face. Susan told Michael that Clark was a witch, and Michael acted as executioner, shooting Clark in the face with a stolen handgun. The Bears tried to burn the body, and when that didn't work, they buried him in the woods of Northern California and skipped town. Police were called to the farm after Clark had been missing for a few days. Side note, this is a cannabis farm, a weed farm, in the early 80s. I can't imagine how worried the people running it must have been about Clark to make the police come to a pot farm in the early 80s. It makes me think that something was very obviously off about the Bears, very obviously concerning about them, and when they went missing the same time Clark did, the people at this farm suspected something was very deeply wrong. So the police come and look around the area, and while they're checking out the woods around the farm, they find a dog playing with what they assume is a ball. It's not. It's a human skull. And soon after, they find Clark Stevens' buried body. The police now had detailed descriptions of the Bears, along with much more information about them, which they sent to police stations across California. In the meantime, the Bears had started hitchhiking again, and they were picked up by a kind 30-year-old man named John Helyar, who wanted company for the 5-hour drive he had to make. While in the car, John's leg brushed Susan's, and she signaled to Mike that he was a witch and now had to be killed. A struggle ensued, and John managed to pull over his truck and get out, stepping onto the road with the Bears following him. Michael and Susan stabbed and shot John right there, in full view of the other people driving on the road. The police were called quickly, and after a short car chase, with the police cornering the Bears, who had stolen John's truck, they were taken into custody. Once in custody, the police realized very quickly that Susan and Michael wouldn't confess to their crimes in any sort of ordinary manner, and it was highly unlikely that they even considered what they'd done as criminal. I would hate to be a reporter at that conference. You think you're helping to crack the crime of the year, or you're going to get a scoop and make your name. Instead, you're part of a police ploy to make two people who clearly need psychiatric help to confess to crimes that they clearly committed, and it takes 6 hours. Anyway, the confession was enough to sentence both Michael and Susan to life in prison, despite them both arguing that they hadn't actually done anything wrong. Both of the Bears wholeheartedly believed that they were doing the world a favor in ridding it of witches, and to this day, they haven't recanted or reneged on any of their beliefs. I picked out this topic months ago, and when I sat down to write the script, I was proud of me from January for accidentally picking a topic that could spin into a conversation both very current and terrifying. Cults. I've seen several people over the last few months argue that Gen Z, aka the generation born between 95 and 2010, will have a cult boom in the same way that the 70s did. And I don't disagree. And it's not because we're weak or sensitive or anything like that. For starters, generational politics are so often a way for people to become divided by pointing fingers at millennials or Gen Z or boomers. And your temperament, your values, and your personality are much more influenced by your upbringing and the people who are around you as a child than they are by an arbitrary age category. Also, I'm 16, and I don't think it'd be a good look to call myself lazy and sensitive. No, I think we'll have a cult boom because the conditions right now are absolutely perfect for anybody who would want to take advantage. Economically, wages have stagnated while housing costs rise, which means that people will be more likely to cohabit with others. I want you to think of all the young people you know who have roommates or housemates. Now, think of how easy it is to manipulate someone if you're with them constantly. In fact, the pandemic's most likely exacerbated this reason. It's hard to get outside perspectives on how your roommate is acting when it feels like the outside doesn't exist anymore. Low wages also mean that people will take whatever job they are offered, which is also an easy way to manipulate someone. And a large number of people will need to work in a field or a job that they aren't passionate about, especially as more and more degrees get called useless, social activism kicks off, and the job market gets worse, especially for those with limited experience. That leads to people seeking fulfillment or satisfaction in a way that leads them open to getting tricked. Furthermore, spirituality is very trendy right now. Just look at the witch community on TikTok or when Sephora sold witch kits for $42 each. If someone is open to spirituality, no matter what branch, that's very easy to manipulate. After all, you don't need to have a source to say God talked to you or your ancestors have called you the Messiah. Add in the fact that we're experiencing a time of massive social and political change, the fact that collective thinking is not only common, because that's been common for all of human history, come on, but is actively reinforced online. The fact that going off the grid or the cottagecore aesthetic is acceptable and normal, and the fact that teenagers aren't the best at nuance. I'm 16, this is coming from a place of realism and concern, but have massive amounts of information in our hands, and you get the recipe for a cult. Now obviously, there is much more to this topic, and this is a severely complex issue. Cults are rarely obvious, they often appear in forms that you would not expect, and they rarely look like the movie version of what a cult is. To be a cult, an organization needs to have a strong commitment to an ideology and idolize or deify its leader. Cults require a massive commitment from their members, and they create a hierarchy, oftentimes delineating those outside the cult as untrustworthy and those inside the cult as good, special, or chosen in some way. Scientology, for example, is well known for its strict hierarchy, where the most untrustworthy people on the planet are those who are not Scientologists. Finally, cults use several methods of manipulation and subjugation. There is no criticism of the cult or its leader allowed. There is no room to air grievances or introduce new ideas, and questioning established rules is a serious offense. Though cults are often thought of as religious, and there is plenty of debate on what exactly separates a religion from a cult, they do not have to be religious. In fact, in an increasingly secular world, it's likely that moving forward, many cults will seem to be rooted in facts or around a certain person's personality and content. Examples of non-religious cults include QAnon, multi-level marketing schemes, diet culture, and some online fandoms, specifically those where any criticism of the creator of the fandom results in harassment. Obsession does not equal a cult. A large group of people can be obsessed with something and not form a cult around it or with each other. So, what's the solution? I told you all that stuff about cults, and at best, it sounded like a distant nightmare or something you'd seen in a movie once. At worst, it reminded you of a situation that you or someone you know is in. If you suspect that something is a cult, or someone you know is involved in a cult, the best thing you can do is remove yourself or them from the situation as soon as possible. Some situations are easier than others. If it's online or mostly online, block people, private your accounts, delete them, switch to new ones, get a VPN, or alert others online to activity that could be dangerous. If it's in person, contact local authorities, especially those that will have an objective view of the situation, and do your best to distance yourselves. In both cases, and in any other scenario, the best thing you can do is lean on your support network. This goes doubly if you're a minor. Contact a teacher, a counselor, parents, your boss, whoever you feel can support you. However, this also goes if you are an adult. A large part of cult recruitment tactics is preying on those who seem alone and don't have a steady support system, as they are easier to manipulate and cut off from the outside world. In both cases, and in any other scenario, the best thing you can do is lean on your support network. This goes doubly if you're a minor. Contact a teacher, a counselor, parents, your boss, whoever you feel can support you. However, this also goes if you're an adult. A large part of cult recruitment tactics is preying on those who seem alone and don't have a steady support system, as they are easier to manipulate and cut off from the outside world. So even if you know one person, even if you aren't sure about how they'll respond, reach out, because every social connection that you have is a barrier against you being hurt or manipulated. One last piece of advice before I wrap up. Do not trust your gut. Cults are very good at making things seem nice and normal and safe, and the longer you've been with them, the scarier the outside world will seem. Trust your head and your logical reasoning over all things. Your gut is not your friend, but your brain has been collecting information for decades in order to rationalize the world and make things make sense. Use that. Terrifying and captivating at the same time, the case of the California witch killers has gone down in infamy and proved just how easy it is to manipulate for one's own gain. I hope this episode of the Shelter and Warning podcast entertained and educated you. If it did, please consider leaving us a rating or review on iTunes. You can find the Shelter and Warning podcast at Shelter and Warn on Twitter, at TikTok, Instagram, and Tumblr at Shelter and Warning Podcast, or contact us through email at shelterandwarningpodcast@gmail.com. Full transcripts of our show, along with a list of all of our sources, are available in our Google Drive. Once again, if there are any corrections or additions that you would like to make, contact me and I will do my best to address them. Thank you so much for listening, and good luck. You'll need it.